ORS 465.110, which is a bill that relates to unlawful practices of establishments for other things that already exist in the law, such as prostitution, or in this case, also illegal abortions and that sort of thing. I had added into that just the place where controlled substances are delivered. What the bill would then allow to happen in the law is if there was a this is a nuisance abatement law, it would allow the local district attorney or a citizen to ask for a injunction against the activity occurring in that house or building, and then to further, in fact, after trial, it was found that that was a knowing activity that occurred there, then the local jurisdiction could shut that house down and deny access to that facility for up to 1 year. What we have is some amendments that I would like to have introduced that since the initial drafting of the bill, I wanted to particularly make certain that there was an adequate coverage for those landlords who, in fact, may not be aware that these activities were occurring, to protect their rights. And secondly, to make certain that it was clear that who we were asking to, if the local law enforcement agencies were to find that somebody was accused of an activity occurring in the house, that the landlord wouldn't have the responsibility trying to shut that facility down, that responsibility would be given to local law enforcement to do, because the landlord is often in a very awkward position in trying to enforce that themselves. So those amendments, which I think we have...
They're passed out.
I missed mine.
I can't find my copy.
You have a copy of those, Mr. Manetta? Yeah. I think it concerns that the reason I asked Mr. Manetta to come up is because once the bill was introduced as a priority bill, and it was in reaction to some things that were occurring in other jurisdictions in Portland and Salem, would to make certain that persons who were in this as landlords or owners or tenants would have their rights guaranteed, and that's basically what these amendments do. Maybe you'd like to just comment generally, Mr. Van Atta, about the bill and even specifically to the amendments.
I am Fred Van Atta, appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon Multifamily Housing Council. We received a copy of, I have before me, I think, a little earlier version of the amendments than the one that you have before you, but they address the specific concerns that are raised by rental property owners where there's an owner-occupant. I don't think a problem arises. Presumably the owner-occupant knows what's going on there and is responsible for it and take action against them. But the problem arises when a tenant is doing something that the owner may or may not know about, and it doesn't seem like it's equitable to lock up the rental house for a year because the tenant was engaged in the things that are addressed in the legislation. Frankly, this an imaginative approach, and while we don't speak to the legal niceties and the legal technicalities of the bill, and we've not had it reviewed for the fine detail, the principles set forth here we think work very well, very quickly. It says the leasehold or the tenancy is the nuisance, and provides a process for the district attorney or the city attorney, depending on the location, to issue notice on probable cause and have a public hearing on whether the described activity is in fact ongoing in the dwelling. If the court determines that the court then is empowered to terminate the tenancy and specifically and direct the vacation of the premises. And if the premises aren't vacated in an orderly fashion, it is then the responsibility of local law enforcement officials to vacate the premises, and you don't send landlords out to get shot by the drug community for trying to kick them out of their rental units. The one area of the bill that I want to look at further and get some advice on is the last sentence, starting on line 20 on page 3 of the bill. However, the private property owner may be held responsible for maintaining a nuisance if, with reasonable care and diligence, the owner should have known of the illegal use of the property constituting the nuisance. Certainly, we're not trying to protect the owner that's knowingly involved. I'm not sure what the penalty is for the nuisance or what the standards are, and that I would just flag that as an area that we're going to at least ask some of our council to take a look at. And those of you that are members of the bar, I would call that to your attention and ask you to reflect carefully on what the implications of that section are. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, my intent, Mr. Madden, members of the committee, is to, I want to get this introduced so we can schedule it for a work session probably next week. I want, and also since the amendments are substantive in nature, to give everyone a chance to look those over. I know your organization may want to. So, any other questions? Representative Springer?
Is it possible, I know the city of Portland has taken some action in this area, might we get a copy of their ordinance? I don't know if council can obtain that from their folks down here.
I think we can probably do that. One of the things that the city has done, and part of the amendments here address that, is that there is the question of who has to serve notice of conviction or eviction in this case. And I think in the case of the city of Portland, that is left with the landlord to do, which is one of the concerns. And this would, in a sense, is not quite as draconian, I guess, maybe I overuse that word, as the local, but we'll get a copy of that perhaps to compare.
I guess this is a question, Mr. Van Natta. Unfortunately, when I was making the rounds last fall campaigning, in parts of the district I represent in Southeast Portland, I had folks clearly identify to me what they thought were drug houses, and they had tried to work with crime prevention and others. And apparently, as they related to me, there had been efforts to notify the landlord. And unfortunately, the response back sometimes, certainly not every time, but sometimes was, that's your problem. What can we do to try to make a landlord who knows about this situation take some responsibility?
If I may, Representative Springer, there is a landlord-tenant bill before you that we could shorten notice on eviction. And give the property owner a more rapid and an easier process for evicting a tenant. I suspect we both know why that is not something that we're probably going to do this session of the legislature. Landlords, frankly, are very tightly tied down by existing statutes on their ability to deal with problem tenants, and certainly we'd be happy to sit down and work with you on a basis to give the property owner clearer, quicker, cleaner authority to vacate tenants from their property that are engaged in objectionable activity. We're not apart from you on that question at all.
Thank you.
President Phillips?
I haven't had a chance to go through your proposals. What do you do to protect the primary person, such as a mortgage holder who has an interest in the property? But certainly if they were getting notice that this cease and desist, if you will, the activity, how do we protect them in the process?
I would think, Representative Phillips, you'd look at the requirements for who notice has to go to on the hearing and make sure that all of those people with mortgages and other interests on the property receive due notice of the hearing that is triggered by the action of the district attorney or the city attorney. And I don't know whether this language gets you there or not, but that's the process, certainly in my mind.
Okay, so you haven't talked to, say, Bronner or Barrows or any of those guys about their...
I received copies of the amendments late this morning.
Let me, Representative Phillips, on that score, these were one of the reasons the amendments were drafted was at their request, and I certainly would intend to have them come back in and notify us on that.
Now, is it my, from what I heard you say earlier, since this was supposed to be scheduled for public hearing instead of work session, we can't move on it today. We've got to wait.
No, I'd really rather wait till we've had a chance to look at these amendments, see if they're whole. Is there any other question, Mr. Banana? If there's anything else that wants to be heard on this particular bill? If not, we'll close a hearing, and we will schedule this for a work session first part next week after we've had a chance to look at those. Another one will add to the file. Okay. Let's go back to the schedule. Let's move to House Bill 2190. And there are, I believe, the amendments. We have a set of amendments, which are -4 amendments. You should have there should be, I think what we ended up, there was a series of amendments, the -2, -3, -4, of course, -1 amendments. Is it the -4 amendments that are the engrossed version now of everything else?
No, they're all different.
Each one is different.
I find my file. Wait a second.
Don't anybody leave. Let's just stand at ease here for about a minute.
Okay.
All right, for those of you who are watching this going on up here, the thing is we have 4 sets of amendments, and I want to make certain that we're moving and discussing these in logic. Let's go to the -4 amendments first. Council, you want to explain the intent? I think the main portion of this that would be found on page 2.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Lines 1 through 11 of page 2. It says that basically, if the defendant does not have resources adequate to obtain independent counsel, but does have resources immediately available to offset a portion of the cost of court-appointed counsel, the court may order the defendant to immediately or otherwise pay into court part or all these resources. Such funds shall be held in trust pending disposition of the case. At the time, the funds shall be deposited to the credit of the state general fund if the defendant is convicted. The accusatory instrument is dismissed pursuant to a civil compromise or diversion. In all other cases, the funds shall be returned to the defendant. We discussed this the last time, and I received a memo, and I want to check it in my files. It really calls into question the last couple of lines of that proposal, whether we can, in a civil compromise or diversion, require a defendant to forfeit those funds to the general fund.
Okay. These amendments would be added on to the... to the bill as it stands right now. Would not be any changes. It would leave the rest of the bill intact and would actually just add these on. Is there any, the chair would entertain a motion on the adoption of those amendments, the -4 amendments.
Can I ask a question before the chair does that?
Yes.
Maybe I'm getting fuzzy, but if we discuss the mechanics of establishing the administrative procedures for a trust being set aside and the handling of that money and what it will cost to the court system to actually manage this program? Because I'd hate to implement a program that was going to save money when we find out that administratively it's going to be just an incredible burden.
Could I ask Mr. Linder to, I knew I didn't want you to leave for too long, Bill. Could you comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phillips, for the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. In response to your question, we don't know if this is going to cost us more than it's going to make the state, so to speak. The idea was that if defendants have some funds available, we ought to latch on to those immediately. We presently maintain trust monies for a variety of litigants, many of them in the civil area, but also in the criminal area for people who have posted security, which is being held pending the outcome of their case. When this was discussed in the ad hoc committee that former Representative Hooley chaired, there was an acknowledgement that we would watch the administrative costs, and if it appeared that it wasn't a break-even proposition or better, we'd come to the 89 legislature and say, here's been the experience. We found that we collected this much money up front from defendants, but we found that the cost of administering it exceeded the amount. So it's a shot in the dark in terms of whether it's going to be a money maker or actually cost the system.
One other follow-up, if I may. So administratively, the function of setting those things up can be done. Are those other funds, those trust funds, susceptible to liens set upon by a third party if that defendant or the accused owes some money through this process? Not necessarily to the state, but to another outside interest.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phillips, we have taken a position based on legal advice that funds being held in trust by the Judicial Department are not subject to garnishment by a third party, and we have not had that challenged for litigation.
Thank you.
Okay, then, but what you are saying, in fact, is that you would have the means, the trust fund, as far as being able to set those things up, is a mechanism already in place, and that's just a question.
Mr. Chairman, it would be more accounts to track, but the process for getting the money into trust exists.
Okay. Any further questions on the Dash 4 amendments? They haven't been moved or anything. Would anyone like to move those?
So moved.
Representative Springer moves the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2190. I get the distinct impression that the enthusiasm for this is waning. Any discussion on the amendments?
I guess, Mr. Chair, it's not a lack of enthusiasm. I think we have laid upon some duties to the Chief Justice that Mr. Linden is going to have to follow up on, and we're devising a system that we think might work because we have the ability to do it. If it doesn't work, we're going to, it's just like some of the other issues we'll be discussing later. In 2 years from now, somebody's going to have to fix it. But it's better than doing nothing.
Doing nothing is always an option.
In some cases, doing nothing is not a bad option.
Okay, is there any, let's ask Kirk call roll on this. Dash 4
Aye.
Amendments.
Miller?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Bruton?
Aye. Okay, those are amended in. Now, we want to go to the Dash 2 amendments. I think
that's still enough to talk about too, but I think we're gonna have front.
Okay. I think we looked at the Dash 2 amendments. This is essentially the pre-screening function. And Ken, do you want to make any comments about this? I don't know if you had an opportunity to do that. I had a discussion with Lizak yesterday and got some indication from some other individuals that a lot of this was kind of going on. The question here is, do we want to codify it? And if we do, does that take away some flexibility that may exist? And then the second part of this is, since we seem to be doing this on a fiscal basis, it's going to save us any money anyway.
My name is Dale Penn, Oregon District Attorney Association. I think there is some misunderstanding about what's happened here. Originally, this was a proposal from Ways and Means, along with several other proposals. It was thought that it may save money. My county and two other counties made the observation that we do this screening now, and we don't see that it will save any money for the state court system, because there are very few cases that are screened out that may have attorneys appointed. On the other hand, it may have a fiscal impact on district attorney offices. So there was some concern here that Mike Schrunk was saying that they are doing screening now, because originally his office was one of those that felt there would be a drastic fiscal impact. And I think there's just a misunderstanding. He's made some statements that there would be significant savings if the DWS bill from Ways and Means, which is another amendment to another statute, would be passed. They are not screening now. He does not see that that would be any fiscal impact. That's what I've been told this morning. I double-checked on that. I went and asked Legislative Fiscal if they had a fiscal impact on this specific amendment, if that was part of the $1.7 million that was going to be saved by this package of bills coming from Ways and Means. Mr. Burke told me that there was no fiscal impact assigned to this bill, and his understanding was the same as mine, that our budget note to the DA budget, which requires us to do a study over the next two years on what the cost savings are and if there's a fiscal impact on district attorneys, that solved this situation as far as this bill was concerned. That was my testimony last week, and I have verified that with Mr. Burke and tried to clarify Mr. Schrunk's statements.
Okay, so you're saying that, in fact, your view is that this could end up having a negative.
We would be asking that this bill, these amendments, not be adopted, that we feel it's covered by the budget note to the DA's budget, and that we will report back to Ways and Means at the next biennium if there are any cost-saving measures. And it's my understanding from Mr. Burke that there is no cost savings attached to this specific amendment for this biennium.
Okay. Do you have a copy of the budget note there, Mr. Lennon, or do you want to comment on this in any case?
Mr. Chairman, it's fair to say that down in Ways and Means, the deliberations on the Indigent Defense budget got very complicated, which is why I think there's some confusion about what went into a particular figure, which I'll talk about. $1.8 million was identified over the coming biennium in potential savings due to legislative changes that would reduce costs of Indigent Defense. Included in that $1.8 million was approximately a two-year figure of $146,000 from the effect of legislation requiring district attorneys to screen traffic misdemeanors prior to filing. Now, the way that number was arrived at was not terribly scientific, but it was presented to the Ways and Means Committee, the Subcommittee on General Government. We found out the total number of misdemeanors filed in 1986 were 73,400. Based on estimates from our courts, we determined that roughly half of those are the major traffic misdemeanors that would be affected by the screening. Then I, based on some discussions with public defenders and courts, came up with an estimate that perhaps 1% of those major traffic cases would be culled out by screening in those counties which don't presently screen. And it's my understanding, based on the district attorney representative on the Hooley Committee, most DAs were not providing this kind of screening, although, as Mr. Penn said, some counties are. The 1% represents 367 cases at a per-case cost of $200. That's $73,000 on an annual basis, or $146,000 on a biennial basis. If this is not implemented, it's one of those things that would have to come off the top of that $1.8 million in potential savings that have been identified. And it's the same situation as we might have on the fish and game cases, because at the time the $1.8 million figure was identified, there was an expectation that some of the fish and game offenses would be knocked down from misdemeanors to violations. Since then, it's been decided that that will be studied over the interim. There won't be any action. So this is another component of the $1.8 million, and there would have to be an adjustment in that amount that's been reserved to the E-Board if the screening is not implemented legislatively.
That is not my understanding of the situation. And I specifically talked to Mr. Burke about this. He told me he was on his way up to talk with either Representative Burton or Representative Springer. It upsets me, quite frankly, that when Mr. Linden wants to have estimates of cost savings, that we go to the public defender's office on something the public defender has nothing to do with. If we're going to talk about screening by district attorneys, I don't know why we aren't discussing this with district attorneys. But this is rather distressing to me, because I hear things coming from different committees, different topics here. But I can tell you that of the three counties that I know that screening is taking place today, in Marion County, in Yamhill County, and in Linn County, every one of those district attorneys will say that the amount of savings or cases that are not filed is minimal at best. And something that no one has even talked about is, of these cases that are filed that potentially may not go all the way through prosecution, how many cases that are weak cases that are filed do people plead guilty and pay fines on, so that there are revenues that the state will lose if we're going to raise our standards, I guess, of pretrial screening. The only thing I would request that before the committee vote on this, that it be verified with Mr. Burke whether or not there really is a fiscal impact for the court's budget. Because my understanding, what I was told specifically, was that there was not.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, in defense of these amendments are amendments that came from the drafts that came out of the Hooley Task Force, verbatim.
Very well aware.
And I'm not going to go, I wasn't at all the meeting, so I'm not 100% sure what went on, but there had been no changes made in the amendments before you from the result of, since they came out of the Hooley Committee.
I'm aware of that.
Mr.
Mr. Chairman, the district attorney member of the Hooley Committee stated that screening could have a potential cost savings effect. Now, if that tune has changed, I'm not aware of it. The $73,000 figure that I reference is contained in a document presented to the General Government Subcommittee on the day that the $1.8 million in total was identified as potential cost savings. So it's been on the blackboard ever since the hearings on the Indigent Defense Budget.
What I have in front of me is interesting, because I'm looking at this again for about the 8,000th time. This is a page out of budget notes, I believe. Is this the one that looked familiar? And when you read where it says one is the have the budget request, that's the 1 year. Okay, then the reductions of a total of $497,000, then it has that broken down into four components, but there's costs only against three of those components. A, which is the effect of reducing penalties in certain misdemeanors driving while suspended cases, doesn't have a cost figure against it.
Mr. Chairman, the $497,000 should have been down further on the page. That relates to A. The $276,000 relates to B. And number C, which is the screening, the one I've been discussing. And that was given to the Ways and Means Committee on the 14th of April.
Okay. It is contentious. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there any discussion on this matter? Anybody want to move them? Nobody wants to move them. Let's go to the Dash 3 amendments. Somebody tell me what these are. This is the ones that became the Dash 4, aren't they?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's really it. What about Dash 1 amendments? Do we need to make that?
We adopted Dash 1.
We already did that.
Those were adopted.
Okay, so what we have is we have House Bill 2190 as amended, which are amended by the Dash 4 amendments.
Didn't we remove the Dash 1 amendments?
We already... I think we already amended that, didn't we? We already amended the dash one amendments in. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the chair entertained a motion to take House Bill 2190 as amended to the full committee. Representative Phillips moves House Bill 2190 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Springer.
Just briefly, I'm going to vote in favor of the motion, but as one who sat through those meetings convened by Representative Hooley, who was then chair of the Subcommittee of Ways and Means, which had responsibility for developing this budget, I do recall that Mr. O'Leary represented the DA's Association, and I thought his contribution was a very positive one in terms of his willingness to compromise. I realize that he was not in the position necessarily, of course, of being able to speak on behalf of all 36 independently elected district attorneys. So I guess I'm personally not surprised that there may be a difference of opinion from the different district attorneys' offices. And certainly we've heard some further expression of that consideration of this bill. One thing, however, was clear, and that's that if we change the laws as it relates to recoupment for cases which have been compromised or diverted, we are probably going to be buying ourselves in the state of Oregon a lawsuit in federal district court. Going to be substantial costs.